The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and tonight we're going to talk music and then software. We'll start with David Wish, the founder and CEO of a remarkable nonprofit organization called Little Kids Rock. In the last 15 years or so, they have brought music education to over 650,000 students across the country and have done so through a method called Modern Band.
Music education actually needs to move at the speed of music,
mm-hmm.
and Modern Band helps do that. So what do children in a Modern Band classroom get to do? They play contemporary music, whether it's rock or reggae or pop or disco, the music of today.
And then I will be joined by the president and CEO of Blackbaud, the 24th largest software cloud company in the world, and one that is exclusively focused on nonprofits. Their software is used by organizations to manage things such as walkathons.
And our software facilitates all of that. It facilitates organizing the team. It facilitates connections through, you know, things like Facebook or other social media avenues. It facilitates actually raising the money and mm-hmm. collecting the donations, and it also facilitates collecting the names and addresses and emails of all the participants, which remain in the database of the nonprofit.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, April 15th. 70% of college presidents are somewhat or very concerned about the prospect of violence on their campuses as a result of issues related to free speech and inclusion, a survey has found. A new study out in the Journal of American Medical Association examines the increases in death among the young. Opioids, alcoholism, suicide, and kidney disease were the main factors leading to the increase in early deaths. And in five states, Kentucky, Oklahoma, New Mexico, West Virginia, and Wyoming, the probability of early death by those 20 to 55 years of age increased by 10% just since 1990. Deborah Spar, the president of Lincoln Center, who was formerly the president of Barnard College, has announced a resignation just 1 year after starting in the position. As I look back on the last 12 months, I ultimately determined that the fit I'd hoped for had not materialized, she said. It is for that reason that I have decided it is best for the organization for me to step aside. And over at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they announced on Tuesday that Max Hollein, 48, currently the director and chief executive officer of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, will become its 10th director starting this summer. And finally, scientists think that cockroach milk could be the next superfood. It's more than four times as nutritious as cow's milk, and researchers think it could be the key to feeding our growing population in the future. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back with David Wish of Little Kids Rock right after this.
You probably know Sesame Street as the TV show that taught you letters and numbers. But Sesame is so much more. Sesame Workshop is a nonprofit with a mission to help all children grow smarter, stronger, and kinder. Big Bird wants to help, so he started the Yellow Feather Fund to bring education to children in need. You can help too. Visit yellowfeatherfund.org to learn more or make a donation. That's yellowfeatherfund.org.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
My next guest believes that we are all innately musical. He also believes, like so many of us, that the way music education has disappeared from many of our public schools is tragic. But unlike many of us, he's done something about it, at first with 30 first graders, and now he has helped restore and revitalize music education for more than 650,000 low-income children across the country. He is David Wish, the founder and CEO of Little Kids Rock. Good evening, Dave, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you so much for having me, Denver.
So you were a first grade teacher in East Palo Alto back in about 1991, and it was there a few years later that the initial idea of what was to become Little Kids Rock was born. Tell us about that founding story.
Well, yeah, my first year of teaching, I found myself in the murder capital of the United States unwittingly. I did want to work in a community where I knew that my passion for teaching could have an impact. And so when you're in that kind of an environment, all you want to do is make a difference. And for me, it was clear I could bring harmony to my kids, literally and figuratively. There was no music program in the area, and so I started giving as a musician myself. I just decided, well, I'm going to teach my kids to play. And so I begged and borrowed a bunch of musical instruments from my musician friends who owed me favors and such, and we started a music program that really focused on the music that the kids knew and loved. So these were, they were listening to Selena and the Backstreet Boys and the pop music of the day, and they were passionate about it. And so I wanted to leverage that. So we just started learning the music that was important to them, and I could see the transformation immediately. And I saw shy kids like Esmeralda start stepping up. Mm-hmm. I saw, tough kids like Christian starting to soften up. And I saw a collective sort of just a beautiful bond that's formed between the kids that wasn't there before that the music brought.
And then what happened with your first graders? More and more kids in the school wanted to be part of the action.
Yeah, we started. So I also taught the kids to write their own music. So, and I remember, these are very small people, first graders, 6 years old. And so we started releasing our own CDs. And all of the other kids in the school started saying, like, well, why are the first graders having all the fun? So I started a class for the second graders, for the third graders, for the fourth graders, all before school, after school, during my lunch hour. And at a certain point, I hit a wall. And that wall was, there was no more time in the day to reach more kids. And yet more kids kept coming and coming. And so it forced me to think about, how do I not be the mean guy who has to say, no, you don't get to have music while all your friends do? And I turned to other school teachers and I said that I knew had some kind of a background in music. I said, listen, let me show you what I'm doing here. I was rich in instruments at that point because we were selling those CDs and the funds from that were funding our instrument needs. And suddenly the program just started replicating. It wasn't just me with all of my kids having all the fun. It was me and other teachers. And music started to propagate across the entire school and actually in neighboring schools because word traveled. We got early support from people like Carlos Santana and Bonnie Raitt, who heard the kids' music being played on local radio stations and who contributed funds and time and classroom visits. And after a few years of that, it suddenly dawned on me, like, well, there's something bigger here than just this program I'm doing locally as a school teacher. And this problem is really national. You know, the arts education being removed, music education being deprioritized. And I knew that I was onto something that could stem that tide. And so in 2002, I decided to, at the summer, and when school was over, not renew my time as a school teacher, but start Little Kids Rock as a nonprofit organization for impact.
Fantastic. Let me pick up on what you just said. What is the state of music education in the nation's public schools currently?
Well, that's an excellent question. There are certainly millions of students that do not have access or participate in music education at their schools. The truth is, there's no national figure because it hasn't been prioritized. Now, the Every Student Succeeds Act that Congress passed makes music education a core subject that has to be provided to all children, quote, regardless of their personal circumstances. That's a historic first. So the wind is at our back. Now it's up to arts advocates to start painting the picture and filling in the numbers. So, for example, there are a few states where we can tell, like in California, the average statewide participation in music education at the middle and high school level is 14%.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. When you consider how passionate kids are about music, what is going on that only 14% of kids are participating in music programs in California? We don't know the data for all of the states, but we know that it's a huge need. And we also know that there are a lot of people that believe that this is something can be transformational for education in general. And I'm optimistic. I'm upbeat. I actually think that music education being universally available and its benefits universally shared by students is something that I'm going to see in my lifetime, and we can all expect to. I'm only 50, so hopefully I still have some time.
We'll stay in shape.
Yeah, got to go to the gym.
And I know music education is just not important to you. You really feel it's a social justice issue. Why don't you share with us your thinking around that?
Yeah, I would say, so first and foremost, some of the research points to the fact that children in low-income communities are less likely to to get music education. And that even in communities where parents are better resourced, they're paying for it. It's something an extra and above and beyond. And of course, low-income families may not have that kind of disposable income. So I think it's a social justice issue in that vein. I also think it's a social justice issue in that, you know, I'm a strong believer in the First Amendment and in every person having a voice and in our democracy. And there is something about music that empowers people to express themselves in ways, you know, I can't remember who said, you know, music is, you know, is takes over where words fail.
Yeah.
There is just something so powerful about the agency that music gives children. And I would say that it's not just performing other people's music. That, of course, is important. That's like reading great literature. But what about writing your own music? And that's one of the things that I think is our program, Little Kids Rock, is really well known for, is empowering students to compose their own music. They're going to have to compose their own future, mm-hmm. right? This is not much of a stretch in my mind. It's actually a direct analog. If you, you know, you have to make up your future, and children are the future of our planet,
sure.
thankfully. I don't think the adults are showing that they're doing a bang-up job at this exact moment. But children, I think, so anything that we can do to give them, you know, people say the future of the world lies in our children's hands. I actually say that the future of the world lies in our children's creativity. That's mm-hmm. the asset that they're really going to use.
Yeah.
And music brings that out in ways that little else can. So it's a social justice issue because it gives voice to the voiceless. It's a social justice issue because it's not being evenly and fairly distributed across children. You know, kids who live in this zip code don't get it, whereas kids in that zip code do. That just doesn't. That's not how public education should work in my mind.
And it's not that big of a stretch either, in that if you take a look at all the refrigerators around the country with magnets on them, the art up there is not, you know, something that Picasso or Rembrandt did. It's their own creation, and you're really applying the same kind of sensibility to music.
Without a doubt. And we're helping music teachers that may not have been trained to do that understand how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just about homages to the past. It's about building the future right now, because the kids are that future.
Let's talk a little bit about your methodology, and part of that is around music as a second language. What is the philosophy that informs that approach?
Sure. And this is the thing that I think makes us really defines who we are. We start with the belief that every human being, no matter how insecure, no matter how many negative messages they've received from anybody, every human being is profoundly musical. And it's simply our job as educators to draw that music out, not to drum it in.
Hmm.
Now, the reason we call it music as a second language is that's very much like we are as musical as we are linguistic creatures. We speak. No one teaches us to speak, right? They merely speak around us when we're infants, and we acquire the ability to speak. It's not like your parents sit down with you one day, Denver, and they're like, listen, we noticed that you say mama and papa. Well, those are nouns. So since you're showing a talent for nouns, we're going to double down on nouns, and we're going to teach you all these other nouns like cat, dog, fish. No. We just use language for meaning in our day-to-day lives,
mm-hmm.
and it's like osmosis. It comes into us. And so the same is true of music. So you have all of these people who have incredible pent-up musicality, and due to only one way of teaching or a limited way of teaching, you wind up limiting the people who can express their musicality. For example, if you say that musicality must be expressed through singing, what does that say for the drummers in the crowd or the guitarists in the crowd or the hip-hop artists or the lyricists, etc.? If you say that the only pathway to making music is through reading musical notation, what about children who have learning disabilities,
yeah.
etc.? So our methodology makes learning or acquiring music and making music just as natural as speaking is. And we show that methodology to music teachers across the country. In fact, we've trained over 4,000 music teachers in our methods. And now colleges and universities across the country that are preparing the next generation of music teachers are using our method to make music education, their music ed programs, more inclusive, because we want every child to have music. Music for every child and every child for music.
Well, your organization has invented an entirely new kind of school music program, and that's called Modern Band. And this has been adopted by public schools in L.A., New York, Chicago, Dallas, Hartford, and so on. What is Modern Band?
Sure. For people who are listening that are familiar with school music programs, people can picture what a marching band is, you know, at the football game, or they can picture what a jazz band is, or they can picture what an orchestra or a chorus is. Well, each of those are sort of separate classes, typically at a school. Well, what is modern band? Modern band is a music program that teaches children to play the culturally relevant music of their generation. It brings music education into the now.
Mm-hmm.
These other forms of music education are invaluable ways of preserving the past. And sure, there's a connection to the future as well. It's not like jazz is going anywhere, et cetera. But music education, the world of music has changed dramatically over the last 50 years. And not so much music education. So modern band brings music education forward and brings in, because music is no longer recorded, disseminated, learned the same way it was 50 years ago. So music education needs to reflect those changes. Music education actually needs to move at the speed of music.
Mm-hmm.
And modern band helps do that. So what do children in a modern band classroom get to do? They play contemporary music, whether it's rock or reggae or pop or disco, the music of today. They play it on instruments that are of those genres, guitar, bass, drums, keyboard, technology. And modern band is the latest sort of category of music education to enter the public school system in the wake of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz was sort of introduced in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
So modern band is this new thing. And yeah, we invented it with our partners. And currently there are over 3 million students that attend school districts that have adopted modern band as an official part of their in-school music curriculum.
Well, it's very nice when kids can see themselves in the curriculum. And I guess it also probably helps with their cool factor when they're playing something that all their contemporaries like.
Sure. Yeah. And if you unpack the word cool, cool is like, you know, I'm accepted by my peers. I'm admired by my peers. I feel self-confident in front of my peers. And these are traits that I think we would all want for our own children.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly teachers want for their students.
Yeah, and these kids aren't playing music right away. This isn't like going to class and writing things down and learning and doing notes. They're making sounds together almost instantaneously.
Yeah, one of the things we like to say is that D comes before E in the alphabet, so do and then explain. So it's a lot of hands-on music making, and the things like theory and reading come once children have the ability, just like back to the language analogy, you don't learn to read before you learn to speak. You speak, and then reading has more meaning.
Mm.
It's very easy to get a child, quote unquote, speaking on an instrument, playing mini songs on guitar or piano or what have you, in a matter of months, weeks, days, minutes in some cases. Now, once a child can do that, it makes much more sense when you say, well, hey, by the way, that song that you're playing by Lady Gaga, you know, it basically has four chords. Well, what's a chord? Well, remember when you were doing this? That's a chord. That's a C major. That's a G major. That's an A minor, et cetera.
Yeah.
But if you start with that, you can lose kids really quickly.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of people in the audience will remember their own music education, and they might look back and say, well, I didn't have talent, or I didn't understand, or I couldn't follow. And what I would flip that on its head, and what I would say is, no, actually, the educator that you worked with, whether it was private or school, didn't really leverage the way that you're hardwired to learn, you as an individual.
Little Kids Rock also donates musical instruments to the schools where these programs are being held. Tell us about that process. I mean, do you buy them? Are they donated? How do you go about all that?
Sure. So we give four things to every school teacher that we work with. First, we train them in our methodology. How can you make music education inclusive and expansive? Then we give them the curriculum we've developed, which they use to teach in their schools, and we give them instruments, and we link them together in a community, a sort of a community of practice. So the most expensive part of that is the instruments. You know, ideas are these beautiful things because you can they're something you can give away to people and still keep for yourselves, but not so instruments. So the way that we work that is we work with foundations, individuals, corporations in the various school markets we're in. We're in about 275 U.S. public school systems.
Mm-hmm.
And our cost for going into a school and launching with a full set of modern band instruments, curriculum, and training is about $5,000 a site. So it's not actually such a heavy lift.
No, not at all.
And it leverages the two things that every school has, teachers
and
a site. So we don't have to build a separate school. We don't have to hire a separate person. We're leveraging that. So we're now working on a model where we're only offering training in school. So let's take a school community with high resources, like in California, where we said only 14% of kids participate. What about a well-to-do school district where 14% of the kids are participating? Why might that be? Are those kids any less interested in music? Well, no. So what if we trained the music teachers, even in those districts, to make their music programs even more inclusive, even more expansive? Well, that would bring more children into music making. And we can do that just by training them and giving them our professional development. We don't need to buy instruments for them. They have already got the resources
right.
for that. So we're trying to – currently there are somewhere in the neighborhood of 75,000 public school music teachers. We're working with about 2,500 of them. Our goal in 10 years is to be working with 55,000 of them. And we believe that with a blended model of philanthropy where it's necessary and fee for service where it's possible, we will reach that target. And the thing that's going to drive us to that finish line is people understanding internally in the U.S. public school system just how much better music makes the schools. I like to joke, you know, like they add music to everything, to music, excuse me, they add music to everything, to commercials, to movies, to weddings, to funerals, to the bathroom sometimes in public places. But let's take it out of school. That will make education better. Yeah. Someone please explain to me how that makes any sense. So schools, I think administrators, they get it, but they don't get necessarily how to scale it.
Yeah.
And that's where we really come in. We've got a way that we can train any school teacher that's a music teacher to bring children who might not come into an existing program through those doors and stay there. We also have a program where we work with general ed teachers, people who aren't music teachers but have some kind of background in music, so that if there is no music program at the school, we can start a beachhead program, even if it's just as an after-school program. And what we've found over the last 16 years is quite often that third-grade teacher that we trained to run an after-school enrichment program, the principal will be so taken with what it looks like to suddenly have music in their school that they'll say, you know what, Mary? You're doing a bang-up job as a third-grade teacher, but we love this music thing. We're going to actually hire you to be our music teacher. I can get another third-grade teacher that'll be great, but I've never seen this in our school before. And so we have, you know, last year we tracked, we had over 110 music teachers hired at our schools that already had music programs, you know. And so basically that's how we're restoring music where it's been eliminated.
You know, when you start to talk about scaling, that takes us to New York City, because what a bigger place to scale. And you have a great program called Amp Up NYC, and that initiative is a partnership with Berklee College of Music and the New York City Department of Education. Tell us about it.
Sure. So that partnership was launched as a result of the work that Roger Brown of the Berklee College of Music was doing with the Quincy Jones Music Consortium. We were both board members. And, you know, Berklee is one of the most forward-looking music education institutions in the world. And I like to think that Little Kids Rock is similarly forward-looking, but in the schools. And so we had just gotten the New York Department of Ed to adopt Modern Band officially as a program. And we were in about 70 schools, and Roger and I concocted a sort of a partnership that would leverage the higher ed resources of the Berklee College of Music with the boots-on-the-ground training capacity of Little Kids Rock and the desire of the largest public school system in the United States, the New York Department of Education, to bring more children into music to create Amp Up New York City, which has scaled Modern Band throughout the New York Department of Ed. We launched it about 3 years ago. Currently, nearly half of all music programs that are in New York City have teachers that have been trained and equipped by Amp Up New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And collectively, they've brought the transformational gift of music to nearly 80,000 students.
That's great.
And those programs are as permanent as those positions are in the schools. In other words, you know, we have trained over 500 music teachers. Those teachers are going to continue doing Modern Band for as long as they're in the program. And our goal in the next several years is to scale up to reach over 75% of all music teachers in the city, so that a teacher might be doing marching band or jazz band, of course, but they'll also be doing Modern Band. And what we're looking to do is make it it should be more normative that a music education program can reach children anywhere they happen to be than that they wouldn't. So that a program that, you know, it'll be unthinkable that there'll be school music programs that don't leverage the cultural capital of the children that they serve, because like you said, children need to see themselves reflected in their curriculum. Not only, of course, we can expose them to all kinds of things, but exposure without cultural relevance can be a little bit like when we were kids, our parents liked to expose us to chicken pox so we would never catch them again, right? We would get it as a little kid, but then we'd be like, okay, well, that cured me. So you can expose children to lots of things, but if none of it's taking, you're actually still not doing your job. It's not enough just to expose. You need to include. It's access is not the answer. Participation is the answer. So I'll tell your listeners that, give you an analogy. If I have strep throat and I have access to antibiotics, but I don't take them, that's not really what we're going
for.
Doesn't
help.
Yeah, so yeah. Same thing. Having access to music education, sure, it starts there. But unless a child's participating, it's just checking off a box.
Mm-hmm. Does chicken pox lead to shingles?
I believe so. So you got to be careful.
That's a different show.
Yeah.
You mentioned before you've been able to enlist the support of some major celebrity musical performers in this effort. Who are some of them been, and what do they do for you?
Well, yeah, some of the earliest were Carlos Santana and Bonnie Raitt and John Lee Hooker, who lived close to where my initial sort of program was, visiting schools, donating instruments. Carlos has the Milagro Foundation, of course, which has been a generous contributor for many years. But also every year we do we do benefit events. So we've had people like Elvis Costello, Lady Gaga, Steven Van Zandt, Bruce Springsteen come out for our annual benefit event. We also have had wonderful artists do actual curriculum for us. Like, we like to create curriculum that features some of our artist friends because they're inspirational and aspirational for our children. So they get involved in all manners of ways. And I think that one of the reasons that what attracts them to the program is they're living what we're teaching the children to do.
Yep.
You know, we're showing them how to write their own song. So if you're somebody like Slash from Guns N' Roses, you know what that feels like to write your own music. You know what it feels like to have someone sing a song that you wrote. So, of course, it resonates for a person like him.
Mm-hmm. You know, I know you've done some evaluative studies conducted by folks like Teachers College at Columbia University, and they're not just looking at the students. They're also looking at the teachers. What have you found the impact of Little Kids Rock, modern band, to have been in these schools?
Sure. Well, the impact is on the students, on the teachers, and actually even on school community.
Yeah.
Teachers express overwhelmingly that they're experiencing greater connection to their students, greater connection to their schools, and greater overall job satisfaction. There's an emerging picture that educators that embrace this approach to teaching stay in teaching for longer.
Hmm.
And that's really important, writ more largely in terms of just education. One of the challenges that inner city schools face is a high teacher turnover rate. And, you know, if you were a company or a business, you would say, wow, if we keep losing staff, what does that say about us? Why do we have to keep retraining people? All that means is that your salespeople or your marketing people are the least experienced people out there, and you want the most experience. So if we're helping music teachers stay in the career, in the profession for longer, that's a completely different angle on service, and the data are beginning to show that. Similarly, students are showing benefits in ways that are not necessarily directly related to music, but highly correlated with better attendance, highly correlated with higher academic achievement overall. So, and this all underpins a growing body of scientific research and evidence in the field more broadly. If there are studies that are showing that music education has no impact or a negative impact on students' overall outcomes, I have yet to see a single one. And people can find all kinds of wonderful studies online at a website called NAMM.org, NAMM.org. ORG. There's all kinds of research there. Furthermore, in New York, we haven't released this study yet, but I think it's a telling one. We worked with Quadrant Arts that showed that schools that have this program in New York, and there are hundreds of them, are highly correlated with over a third higher participation rates in music in New York City.
Wow.
So, you know, that's a big deal to say, wow, a third more children will participate in music education if you offer this as an option. That's a strong correlation and a wonderful area for exploration as we try to make music education matter for every kid.
Let me close with this, Dave. Share with our listeners a story or two of children, or maybe children and their parents, who have been part of Little Kids Rock and what it has meant to them.
Sure. So I'll frame this just by saying that music brings people together in ways that very little else can.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly during this time, which I think every listener or most listeners would agree would be one of the most divisive periods in recent memory, easily, the role that music plays is pretty powerful. And I'll start with there's a poem that has a short stanza. It says, "We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams, world losers and world forsakers upon whom the pale moon gleams. Yet we are the movers and shakers of the world forever, it seems." That term, movers and shakers, mm-hmm. appeared for the first time in the English language in that poem. So even though we're interviewing here at Wall Street, it was never meant for the titans of industry. It was meant for musicians who change the way we see the world, who change the way we see each other. And it's always been that way throughout history. That's the power of music. That's the power of the arts. A story about how I've seen that manifest itself in a particular child's life, there are a lot. But here's one in particular. There was a little girl, we'll say her name was Marla, and her family were refugees from the war in Kosovo.
Okay.
They had lost family members. They had come over. They landed in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, mm-hmm. not a great neighborhood, a very challenging community. And the whole family living in one small apartment. And the mother and father got into a huge argument over the stresses of daily life. Who knows what it was about? And the mom and the dad were screaming and yelling, and Marla grabbed her guitar and went into the bathroom and slammed the door and started playing music. And the mother and the father stopped arguing, and they looked at each other, and they listened to the music, and they started to weep. And they wept for their lives, and they wept for their circumstances, and they wept for the fact that they lost themselves in front of their child, and they wept for the power of the music coming through that bathroom door just as a nonverbal cue, like, people, please. And the reason I know this, I wasn't in the house. Marla's mother came to me and explained to me, "You don't know what this program means to my family. You don't know what this program means to my daughter, to my husband." And I've got to say that I have the privilege still of being in touch with Marla, who's now probably in her early 30s, and many of our students. And what I've noticed is the impact of music education lasts a lifetime. It's not about what children are doing during the school day. Of course it is. But it's you know, I like to say that, you know, music I don't think we invest in music education because children can make music beautifully. We invest in music education because it can make children beautiful. And it makes, for me, it gives me hope that we can restore civility and harmony. Our national motto has music at its core. E pluribus unum. Out of many, one.
Mm-hmm.
Not out of one, one. Not it's my way or the highway. It's not, no, the people who don't agree with me are an existential threat to my existence and I will do anything to overpower, overawe, and overcome. It's like, no, we are all different voices in this great American chorus and we better sing in harmony if we're going to live up to our creed. Otherwise, there are lots of examples across the planet of people who give up that ghost, of people who say, you know, democracy was a great experiment, but we don't have the wherewithal to stick with it. And I think that the soundtrack of keeping our democracy alive and healthy, part of it can begin with the music, because the music forces harmony. The music forces listening. You can't be a good band member if you're only listening to yourself. So to me, you know, we are the music makers and we are the dreamers of dreams. That resonates. And that we are the movers and shakers. That's what education has to contribute to this country right now. And music education has its very own special contribution that it can make. And that's why I believe in the possible and the now and the urgency.
A very nice note to end on. Well, David Wish, the founder and CEO of Little Kids Rock, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and how listeners can become involved if they should be so interested in doing so.
Yes, please visit www.littlekidsrock.org, and you can learn more about the program, ways to get involved, ways to support and donate. You can contact me or my team through there. You'll see all of our contact information. But furthermore, there are a bunch of lessons that you can take if you are yourself an aspiring music maker, or let's say you have a child in your life that you love and would love to connect to music. There are many resources there as well. We share the same resources that we give to our children and teachers in schools with the general public. So you are a music maker too, if you hear the sound of this voice, or even if you don't, likely you are. So, you know, make music and make the world a more harmonious and beautiful place.
Thanks, Dave. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Likewise, Denver. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. Follow The Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to The Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
Whether you use their services and products or not, there are very few people in the nonprofit world who are not familiar with the name Blackbaud. They are the one company that is synonymous with software being deployed by organizations to power social good. And it's a real pleasure to have with us tonight their president and CEO, Mike Giannone. Good evening, Mike, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver.
Tell us about Blackbaud and give us a little history of the company.
Sure. Blackbaud is headquartered in Charleston, South Carolina. We are a publicly traded software company. We are now the 24th largest cloud software company in the world in any category. And what's unique about Blackbaud is we are exclusively focused on the social good economy. And so our customers are customers that are nonprofits, you know, sort of classic charities like an American Heart, American Cancer, Save the Children, also higher education institutions like Clemson University or Georgia Tech or Yale University, and K-12 private schools. We have thousands of K-12 private schools around the world. In fact, we have over 40,000 customers globally in over 50 countries.
Wow. And you work exclusively 100% with nonprofit organizations. How do you believe that improves your offerings for the sector?
Well, what it does, Denver, is it produces a focus for us in how to drive digital transformation in the nonprofit sector across these different types of nonprofits. And so our solutions are not provided to for-profit institutions. And so we're not trying to sort of retrofit a software solution into the space. Our engineering efforts are solely focused on the needs of these types of institutions.
Yeah. I mean, do you find a difference? I know you came from private industry. Do you find a difference in selling to nonprofit entities than what you experience when you're selling to businesses?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's not really different because the desires that nonprofits have are equivalent to financial services institution or a manufacturing institution, which is, you know, how do they get value out of advanced software capabilities to either drive their revenue or reduce their operating cost and make their operations more efficient? It's the same needs. And in fact, what's happened in software, because software has impacted our personal lives so much, you know, we conduct our personal banking on a phone now.
Mm-hmm.
The expectations are high, whether you're in a nonprofit or a for-profit, which is, you know, why can't I conduct my business life like I conduct my mobile banking life on my phone?
Exactly.
And so those things start to kind of cross over.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take an example of an event that a nonprofit might conduct to raise funds and see how Blackbaud can help support and enhance that function. I think everyone in this audience has either participated in a walkathon or helped contribute to a walkathon. Tell us how Blackbaud's suite of services would help support that event from start to finish.
Sure. So, you know, an event like a walkathon or a bicycling event, they're typically, you know, organized by volunteers who will organize a team and then connect with you know, teammates, could be via social media connections, and then start to raise money and organize folks for the particular event. And our software facilitates all of that. It facilitates organizing the team. It facilitates connections through, you know, things like Facebook or other social media avenues. It facilitates actually raising the money and collecting the donations. And it also facilitates collecting the names and addresses and emails of all the participants, which remain in the database of the nonprofit for a future outreach, for another future, you know, walk or bicycle ride or another campaign.
Yeah, and what are some of those products that help facilitate it?
So we have quite a few products. We have CRM products. That's sort of the data repository for the names and addresses and contact, and also the giving history.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have online solutions that connect everybody together, and they're integrated with things like Facebook and Twitter and other social media. So we tie all that together and into single systems purposely built for a nonprofit to conduct a walk, for example, like American Heart Walk.
Gotcha. Now, speaking from a perspective of a donor for a minute, explain how a nonprofit organization using Blackbaud will impact, change, enhance, and manage that organization's relationship with the donor.
Sure. So there's lots of ways to do that depending on donor type, and they're all very different, right? So if you're, for example, a K-12 private school, the focus there as a donor is a potential parent of a child in that school is typically the focus or an event. If it's a university, it's an alumni, right? If it's a church, it's a parishioner. So it's all a bit different. So if I choose an example like a university will collect information on their alumni, and they'll sort of track the alumni based on the degree they got. Did they participate in a sport in the school? You know, where are they now in their career?
Mm-hmm.
And can they conduct an outreach to this alumni to convert them into a potential donor based on, you know, our software helping the school create a campaign to connect to that alumni and bring them back into the awareness of what's happening at the institution.
Yeah, and you even have artificial intelligence built into some of these products, correct?
Yeah, we do. And the artificial intelligence really makes the data actionable for the nonprofit. And so, you know, we'll have things for, say, a major gift officer at a university. Our software will give them a predictive next step.
Mm-hmm.
So it might say, you know, for these 10 potential donors, you know, here's what their profile is, and here's your predicted next step of how you might interact and contact that donor, as opposed to just leaving it to the major gift officer to come up with that creative outreach. The software will have suggested examples on how to do that.
Yeah, it even might even suggest what to ask them for, how much.
Yeah, it does. It suggests how much to ask them for and why, potentially. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of intelligence that we build in to our solutions to do that. And we have some that are specific for market type, too. So we actually have, you know, some artificial intelligence for hospitals and healthcare institutions to understand who their patients are and can those patients become potential donors in the future. Also for things like performing arts centers. And so who are my ticket buyers?
Mm-hmm.
And can they become potential donors in the future? And our software helps the institution figure that out.
Yeah, really interesting. Blackbaud also provides one-stop shopping in a sense, because even if your company, Mike, doesn't provide a specific service or product, you have partners that do. Tell us a little bit of how that works and who some of those partners are.
Yeah, we do, Denver. And so we've actually been going much more wider in the type of institutions that we support and what we do for them. So if you go back a decade, we predominantly had software solutions only for fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at us today, in areas like education institutions, we do obviously have our fundraising and our financial systems, but we also have software that runs the school, student information system, enrolling students, classroom management, integrated with the fundraising. So we actually are running the whole of the school, not just the fundraising side of the school. Along with that, we have hundreds of partners in our partner program to specifically answer your question, that actually have solutions that sort of fill even more of those gaps for us in particular institutions. We might have partners for, you know, for churches and things that we don't do, but their solutions are integrated with ours. And so it becomes more of a one-stop shopping. And that's critically important in the markets that we serve, because a big challenge for our customers and potential customers is integrating all of these disparate solutions together is a very big challenge that we've been working on solving the last several years.
Yeah. Well, I know for people like me, for instance, who are interested in keeping abreast of charitable giving at large and online giving specifically, there is the Blackbaud Index. Tell us about that report and maybe what it's been showing for 2018 so far.
Yeah. So we produce a Blackbaud Index, which shows, you know, trends of giving at the macro level, and we're starting to produce those by industry as well. So some of the particular institution types that I mentioned, we're starting to produce that index, so it kind of breaks it down to that level also. And what it's been showing over the last several years is that online giving is growing very quickly. It's growing in the mid-teens as a percentage every year, where total giving grows typically 1.5 to 2.5%, which actually tracks U.S. GDP over the last 40 years in total giving. But online giving is growing in the mid-teens. And so there's a conversion happening from traditional giving to online giving. And our platforms support all of that, both of that. And so we're helping our customers make that more, you know, that transition into more of a digital world and online.
Have you seen some practices by some of your customers that have been particularly effective in the online giving space?
Yeah, I have. You know, there are best practices out there. We help facilitate some of those best practices for online giving. And it really is becoming more of an online-oriented institution. So reaching out online, connecting with social media, understanding the talk tracks that are happening on social media and how it applies to your particular institution. In other words, if you're a university and there's a talk track out on Twitter or Facebook about your university and your alumni are in that talk track, and how do you connect into that and digitally connect and outreach to those alumni and make that a part of your program. And so there are quite a few best practices related to digital online giving and online outreach.
You know, another big challenge that faces a lot of nonprofit organizations is donor retention, which I think is much lower than most people think. What is the average donor retention for a nonprofit, and what are some of the ways that they can help improve it?
Yeah, the average donor retention is sort of all over the map, because it's different if you're a church or if you're a university. Mm-hmm. But there is high turnover, and there are techniques to use, which, again, are best practices that drive donor retention. One of the big trends that's coming to the U.S., mostly from European institutions, is to create sustainers. And that's a donor that might give an amount every single month. So they just sign up for the year. You know, they give every single month on a regular basis, and it's typically the same amount. And so there's sort of a decision point up front to give the same amount for a year, as opposed to a decision point up front to give once.
Yeah.
And so a move to sustainer giving is happening in a lot of nonprofits. But there's also a lot of techniques for donor retention, and some of them are pretty simple. For example, when someone makes a donation for the first time, make sure you have a personal outreach and say thank you. A lot of institutions don't actually do that, but we have the data that shows that significantly drives retention, because there's a personal connection to say thank you for your donation. And the other thing that we have is we have a service that provides scorecards that many of our customers sign up for. And you can think of this as almost like a grammar school report card, where there might be 7 or 8 categories. And in each category, we will rate the institution A, B, C, or D. And that rating compares that institution to hundreds or thousands of their peers. So someone might get a C- in online fundraising, but they might get an A in fundraising at their events.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can help them take that C- up to a B or an A through a better use of technology or better best practices. And that's one of the services that we provide, the scorecarding as well.
Yeah, that's a very useful dashboard. And it's funny, when you talk about donor retention, with all this technology, sometimes just that simple human touch of reaching out, saying thank you is still the best medicine.
So, it is, yeah.
You know, digital transformation is changing the way we work and live. And in certain areas, it's just blowing up existing business models. How can organizations embrace digital change to drive more impact?
Sure. So there's a digital transformation, to your point, happening in every single industry, including the nonprofit industry and all the sectors that we support. And we're driving a lot of that. So for us, a lot of it is building intuitive, mobile-first, well-integrated solutions that create operating environments for our customers that are more frictionless. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, integration is so critically important. If you're a large institution, you might have over 100 systems and from different vendors, 100 vendors. If you're a smaller institution, like a K-12 school, you might have one person that's responsible for your information technology. You might have 10, 15 separate vendors, and the systems don't talk to each other and don't share data. And so sometimes digital transformation is not just simply taking an operation that's manual and making it digital. Sometimes it is, like fundraising, right? If it goes from something that's in the physical world to digital, you've then digitally transformed fundraising. But sometimes it's also just better integration to take all the manual steps that happen between all these disparate systems away. And the whole institution then, in fact, becomes a digital institution because they run their fundraising and their operations in a digital cloud service environment.
And there goes the Tower of Babel inside these organizations. You know, you mentioned before you have tens of thousands of customers, which includes so many brand names, Habitat for Humanity, the American Diabetes Association, but also private schools and hospitals and universities. Share with us a story or two of organizations that have used your products and services and as a result strengthened their program and operations.
Sure. Feeding America comes to mind, where they last year adopted online digital marketing and our integrated donation processing or payments capabilities, and they improved their business by $500,000. Mm. And they were nice enough to make a short video with us, which is on our website. It's about 2 minutes long. And at the end of that video, their chief financial officer says, you know, because we adopted this digital transformation and these set of solutions from Blackbaud, we were able to improve our business by $500,000. And for Feeding America, that's 1 million more meals a year.
Wow, that's impressive.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's impressive. And so we have these kinds of stories across the board. There's a local Habitat for Humanity chapter in Florida where they adopted one of our new solutions, and an outside third-party firm went and studied several of our customers, including them. I think it's in Dade County, Florida, and studied them. And the economic return that they got by adopting one of our new platforms, they paid for our solution in 4 months.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
And because of how their business improved.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ROI, the return on investment, was 4 months. And that information is somewhere on our website, too. And so we have thousands of these stories around the economic impact for the nonprofit through digital transformation. And it manifests itself either in them reducing their operating costs or improving their revenue, which in turn, they put the money back into their core mission, which is a big win for everybody.
Everybody is right. You know, when you arrived at Blackbaud a few years ago, Mike, you found a very siloed culture with each product having its own development approach and methodology. How did you go about addressing that issue and creating a far more integrated approach?
Sure. Yeah, this is my fifth year. I started my fifth year, and so I started in January of 14, and we were very siloed, and we, you know, did not run the company as a integrated operating business, and then that manifested itself with our products not having a high velocity of innovation or lots of integration, which I explained is really important. And so we changed all of that. And so the business is now operating as one business. We have driven a lot more innovation in the last several years. We were called out by, I think it was Forbes magazine, as one of the most innovative companies. And we were on the, I think it's the Fortune.
It's Fortune, right.
Fast Tech 25, one of the most innovative, fastest growing software companies, with companies like Amazon and Facebook and those guys. So the business is a very different business, and it's a much higher velocity business. And so the It runs as a single operating unit as a company, but what happens and what has happened for our customers is now our products and solutions, we put new features in the products every 2 to 4 weeks. Where in the past, it was every 5 to 10 years, we would have a new release of a product. So now when a customer starts to use one of our solutions, it's forever upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
You don't wait for the next big thing. It's changing every couple of weeks.
Absolutely. I'll wait till the end of April, and it will be there. So, you know, you talked about knocking down those silos and integrating and how it's changed everything, but how did you do it? That's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of things that we did, frankly. We put the senior team together in one physical location, so you don't have to wait 2 weeks to get on someone's calendar to have a meeting with the peer. You can see them 5 times a day at the coffee machine. We used some other techniques like having monthly detailed operating reviews. And so the senior team at the company will sit in a day and see the operating reviews of the whole company. And so the team starts to see all parts of the company, not just the part that they're directly responsible for. Because, you know, my senior team, what I like to say is they have two hats. One is the hat they wear for the full-time job they're in, running that part of the business. And the second hat is to help me and the rest of the team run the whole company. And before, I think they only had one hat.
Well, how would you describe the corporate culture of Blackbaud today?
Yeah, so the culture has always been a customer-focused culture. And we actually attract a lot of people given the customers that we have and the focus we have. But because of the siloed nature, it was very difficult to operationalize that focus. And so the culture today is, you know, very much an open, transparent culture. You know, I personally have worked with the top 200 people on something in the last year. And, you know, it's a very customer-focused environment that, you know, again, really draws a lot of folks for us. And because we've been successful, you know, as a publicly traded software company, you know, we attract people who want a career in the software industry and who want to do something good and help these kinds of institutions become better. It's really a perfect combination.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Mike. We have seen some sweeping changes over the past several years, which are only going to accelerate. Where do you see the market going in the next 5 years, and how will Blackbaud both prepare for and help shape that market?
Yeah, I think it's what you mentioned earlier, which is this digital transformation. And as a nonprofit institution, they all have to ask themselves, how does that apply to me? And how do I improve my institution through, you know, a digital transformation? And what does it mean for me everywhere in the institution, not just the Department of Fundraising, but everywhere? And can I, you know, improve my mission, whatever that might be, and have a bigger impact in the world by leveraging, you know, advanced software technology to help me do that and rethink my operation, rethink that I have a physical operation, and can that parts of it be digitized? And in a digital world, you can actually manage something globally a lot better than a physical world. And so I think that change is a complex one, right? It's very different for every institution. And, you know, some institutions have a different digital transformation in front of them on the mission side than others. For example, in higher education, online learning is becoming a pretty big deal as opposed to actual campus learning.
That's right.
And so how do they incorporate a digital experience for remote students that don't come to the campus? Core mission being delivered digitally as opposed to physically is a big change. And they're thinking about, you know, how that transformation may come. And that applies to all the institutions that, you know, that we work with. And so I think that will accelerate. I think that the tools for them will become easier and easier to use. It's a big focus of ours. We want our customers to be able to pick up, you know, a mobile device and start to be productive without going to a class, and then go to a class for more advanced training, but not for entry-level training, which is, how do I use this software?
Mm-hmm.
It should be as easy and intuitive to use as anything that's on your phone today. And so I think that will actually accelerate digital transformation when the tools are just intuitive and easy to use. And I've gotten feedback that's the case. I spoke to a woman who's a major gift officer at a university, and she said that for the first time in her life, she works off her iPhone. And it's never happened before. She used to have a whole bunch of paper and fly around the country with files and folders, and she just takes her phone now. and she's able to work that way. She had not yet taken the class for that particular product.
Well, you can't make it simple enough for me. Well, Mike Giannone, the president and CEO of Blackbaud, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this evening. Tell us about Blackbaud's website and about some of the information that visitors will find there.
Sure. On our website, we have some of the information I mentioned, you know, these customer stories where they've been able to really improve their business, like the Feed the America video. And there's many, many customer stories, because at the end of the day, that's what matters on the website. And then there's also, you know, this information coming from our Blackbaud Institute around giving trends. And a lot of those reports are published out and they're available on our website. And we're always updating that. Every month or two, there's some new report around trends and best practices on our website. So there's quite a bit there. And then, of course, there's the traditional, you know, information about our products and services as well.
Mm-hmm. And that website is?
It's blackbaud.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Mike. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Brian Gallagher, the president and CEO of the United Way Worldwide. I know you'll want to be here for that. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.